fire, and obstacles vanish into thin air. Samuel Johnson once said, "Great works are performed not by strength, but by perseverance." Repeated studies consistently indicate that in sales, as well as in other fields, few attributes correlate more directly with success than does perseverance. It is also one of the toughest characteristics to inculcate in oneself. Shrugging off failure and redoubling efforts takes perseverance. Picking oneself up off the ground to where one has been knocked and taking another shot at the goal takes perseverance. Resisting pain, sometimes humiliation too, and remaining stubbornly focused on the task takes enormous reserves of perseverance. How do you enhance your ability to persevere? Perseverance means that you have the ability to follow your head rather than your heart or your body. Using your head, you have determined that your life would be improved if you adhered to a diet and an exercise program. Perhaps you have decided to make 10 cold calls each day at work to increase your sales. It might be something else, like completing a difficult night school credential course for career advancement. There will be many evenings when your heart will urge you rather to spend the evening with a friend. There will be evenings when your body will urge you to climb into bed and go to sleep. Each and every time you overcome one of those urgings and adhere to your plan, you not only come closer to your goal, but, even more important, you have strengthened your perseverance muscle for future occasions. Conversely, each time you submit to the call of your heart or body, not only do you defer achieving your goal, but you have also weakened your perseverance muscle and will find the struggle even harder next time. Like any exercise regimen, it takes time and effort. The important thing to realize is, this is a spiritual strength here. And although it is spiritual, it is strengthened just the way a physical strength would be strengthened. If you want to increase your endurance, you might decide to run several miles each week and gradually increase the distance you run. If you want to increase the strength of a particular muscle group of your body, you would commit to a workout program that would, over time, develop those muscles. There is little difference with spiritual muscles. You have to design an exercise regimen that will gradually increase your ability to persevere. Start off with challenges you know you can overcome. There is nothing worse than failing in the early stages of perseverance training. Then build up gradually until you reach the point where you can fairly, reliably know that you can obey your head and ignore your heart and body when it comes to knowing what you have to accomplish. From the time you were a child, you had opportunities to develop perseverance or diminish it. Each time your parents made you finish homework before allowing you to watch television, not only were they saving you from a teacher's wrath the next day, but they were also helping you develop your perseverance muscle. Perhaps you became a runner, a swimmer, or a rower later on. These, along with other similar athletic pursuits, help to train your body to submit to your head. With any luck, by the time you embarked on your business career, your perseverance muscle was fairly well developed. If not, you didn't go very far, nor did you achieve a great deal. That much is certain. All the facts in the world drummed into your head by a diligent and determined teacher would not take you very far without a well-developed perseverance muscle. So, you must have already done some good work in developing your perseverance muscle. Now, it is just as important to avoid activities and attitudes that erode that muscle. Suppose, for instance, that you wanted to get your weight down to a more healthful level. You would obviously need perseverance to stick to your diet and to your exercise program. Once you had reached your target weight, however, you would need to avoid substances that would needlessly add the weight back again. You might decide to avoid soda pop with its heavy doses of sugar. Similarly, in the case of perseverance development, there are the spiritual equivalents to soda pop that undo all the good work you have already achieved. Chief among these perseverance-destroying ideas is the idea of retirement. Even a subconscious theme of retirement permeating, say, your financial planning can sometimes be enough to hurt you. Note that I'm not discouraging responsible financial planning, but when your planner inquires as to the age at which you would like to retire, your firmly declared response ought to be never. You may well determine that you would like to have accumulated an investment nest egg of a certain size by the time you reach some specific date or age. That is a positive incentive to effort. But telling yourself that you would like to retire by that date or that age is quite different and very destructive. The three lies of the retirement myth. Retirement contrasts dramatically with the ancient Jewish view of how we integrate the passage of time with our careers. Here are the three lies commonly believed about how fabulous retirement is. Lie 1. Work has no value in and of itself. The first lie is that all your work and human creativity is focused on some end, rather than having value in and of itself. By absorbing this lie, you come to believe that you are only working until you no longer need to do so. Oh, happy will be the day when I can finally turn my back on this contemptible activity called work, sings the fool. He claims to be working in order to live, rather than living in order to be able to work. He works 5 days a week in order to be able to live for the 2 days of the weekend, or he endures the terrible work day only to live for the nighttime hours. Allowing the retirement myth into your brain encourages you to absorb the mindset that insists you work only in order to live. In reality, you do live in order to work. A life without those accomplishments that only work can bring is a life in need of constant professional psychiatric reassurance. In his encyclical on the subject of work, Laborem Exercens, Pope John Paul II echoes ancient Jewish wisdom when he suggests, "Work is a good thing for man, a good thing for his humanity, because through work man not only transforms nature, adapting it to his own needs, but he also achieves fulfillment as a human being. Work expresses his dignity and increases it. It provides him with the wherewithal to have a family, and it links him with his neighbor, not to mention also contributing to the wealth of his neighbors. What happens if you really do detest your work? People are often advised to make a profession out of what they enjoy doing. This is generally unsound advice. It is simply not always possible to make an adequate living out of what you happen to enjoy. For instance, I enjoy boating. Trying to make this my profession would probably be disastrous. As the old adage would have it, if you want to know what it feels like to go boating, stand while fully dressed under a cold shower and tear up $100 bills. There are undeniably a few who earn satisfactory livings by working in the vicinity of boats. But they are hardly engaged in boating. Some are running corporations like Bayliner or Sea Ray, which are among the largest boat manufacturers in the world, whereas others may operate real estate enterprises that include marina properties in their portfolios. Very few people, if any at all, earn their living doing nothing but what they happen to enjoy. A far more effective approach is to learn to love what you do professionally. The choice of what to do should never be made on the basis of what you enjoy doing. That violates the central premise of business, which is that success comes to the unselfish. Focusing on what you personally happen to enjoy doing is no way to succeed in business. You should not be so concerned with what you enjoy. Instead, focus on what others need from you and that you can provide. In other words, follow the money. Find the area that pays satisfactorily. That indicates a need on the part of others. That is why there is money in that field. People are in effect saying, "Won't someone come and supply our need? Look, we have real money we are willing to pay." Locate an industry into which you have entry, and that seems to be thriving. Then make it your business to enjoy working there. How do you make yourself enjoy something? The answer is straightforward. Become accomplished and competent at it. It is a reliable fact that you tend to start enjoying anything at which you become competent, and from which you derive a sense of accomplishment. Remember how you hated mathematics, chemistry, or English composition at school? You might also remember how you later came to enjoy the same subject. What changed was nothing but your level of achievement. People desperately need to feel a sense of achievement because it signals that they have been useful to others. They need to feel appreciated by others, and getting paid is one reliable way to gauge that appreciation. People can feel gratitude to their jobs for supplying this sense of achievement. I'm not saying you should never contemplate a change of activity. On the contrary, you should be very open to the possibility of change. Maybe you ought to be in a different field. Perhaps you should have a different employer. There is nothing wrong with that, as long as you do not abandon a situation with vast economic potential and replace it with one that offers minimal monetary opportunity, on the basis that at least you will enjoy what you do. As an ambitious and successful business professional, you should always keep in mind that everything you do must benefit others as much as yourself. You are chiefly in business not only to obtain the things you want, but also to make it possible for others to obtain the things that they want. Were this not true for everyone, even for the fabulously successful Bill Gates of Microsoft, people would cash in their chips, sell their stocks, invest the proceeds in a comprehensively diversified portfolio, and retire to Fiji. Needless to say, in all probability, Microsoft workers and investors would be worse off if Bill actually did retire to Fiji. Computer users around the world may be worse off, and those whose wealth is partially tied up in real estate in the locality of Redmond, Washington, would also suffer loss. The truly successful business professional is never concerned solely with his own welfare. The retirement myth sadly encourages you to believe that you are working only until you no longer have any need to do so. It entirely negates the effect your efforts have on others. Lie 2. People become less productive and less useful as they age. The second lie promoted by the retirement myth is that as time goes by, you become weaker and less capable of making money. It is almost self-evident that if I am indeed edging closer and closer to retirement as I age, Each passing day must be robbing me of just a little more of my money-making vitality. This is a lie. The truth is that unless my business is pounding another boxer in the ring, or charging up a field while clutching a football, each passing day makes me a more effective wealth creator and grants me added potential to create revenue. I say this because making money depends on relationships, and with the passage of time, everyone should possess a larger Rolodex. With the passage of time, you ought to know an increasing number of friends and acquaintances. You ought to be a lot less self-centered, which means that you are better equipped to nurture and maintain those friendships. With growing emotional and psychological maturity, you become a more capable communicator, and you become less susceptible to impulsive actions. With passing years, you often become tougher and more resilient, more experienced at rolling with the punches. You have seen more than one roller coaster cycle. You know how to temper the exuberance of those around you with the knowledge that things don't remain high forever. And you can boost the depression of your associates with the reassurance that things don't remain low forever either. Finally, with the passage of time, provided you have not been consistently jumping from one occupation to another, your areas of skill and your professional competence become better known to those around you. Judaism, through the Bible, insists that you are morally obliged to accord great respect to anyone aged, even those with few academic or material accomplishments. Judaism teaches that no young person, regardless of education or competence, can possibly have accumulated the experience and wisdom about life that most ordinary elderly people possess. Yet, most people view an older person as someone who has started to slow down, as someone walking more slowly, driving a little less certainly than he or she used to do, and even appearing to think for a little longer during ordinary conversation. If the older person is an employee of your organization, you might conclude that it is time to replace him or her with a younger, fresher, and stronger person. It may be true that the particular function in which the older person operates does require greater physical endurance. However, most organizations would be doing themselves a favor by finding a way to retain the experience and the wisdom that comes with age. Many firms, such as mail-order clothing giant Land's End, regularly employ older people to help cope with the end-of-the-year purchasing rush. They have found these older workers to possess a work ethic and a commitment to customer service, utterly lacking among their younger employees. A person's real economic value is spiritual, not physical. You may have a certain economic value, which is to say, a value to your fellow humans as a ditch digger, but it is only a fraction of your real value. Henry Ford used to complain notoriously about having to hire an entire person, when all he really needed was a pair of hands. Today, no successful entrepreneur would be willing to pay a salary to what was merely a pair of hands. What everyone needs from those whom they pay is total commitment of both soul and body. The full spectrum of human creativity can only emerge from a person who sees himself or herself as a totally integrated body and soul, both united in common commitment to the job. By admitting the thoughts to your mind, even subconsciously, that I am only 15 years away from retirement, or that I only have to work for 10 more years, you effectively persuade yourself that your strengths are diminishing and that you are winding down your revenue-producing activities. In other words, with each passing day, you see yourself as less and less useful to your fellow humans. Nothing could be further from the truth. If you work for a company with a mandatory retirement policy, you can hardly help reminding yourself that you only have X number of years left to work. Nonetheless, even in that situation, it will pay to recognize your oncoming retirement date as the date you are switching occupations, rather than as the date you are ceasing to work. When that date comes, or preferably well before that date arrives, you should have prepared your next landing site. Perhaps you will buy a small business, or maybe you will hang up your shingle and start consulting. What consulting means is that you continue to operate in your established field of competency, but you do so as an independent contractor rather than as a full-time employee. Many employees whom I have advised about this kind of transition have successfully negotiated consulting contracts with their former employers, who were as eager to retain the services of their former employees as the employees were to remain active. No matter what you do, remember that you can always fine-tune your activities to restore the reality that with passing years, you are more helpful to the world, not less. Even as a football player or as a boxer, your best years may well lie ahead as coach, advisor, or consultant. Lie 3. People are merely consumers rather than creators. The third lie that springs from the myth of retirement is that people, and that includes you, are consumers rather than creators. Until you retire, you are occupying a slot at the food trough. So the only decent thing to do after an appropriate interval is to move out of the way and let someone else in to get their opportunity to feed. In this scenario, retirement is the way people are cycled through the economy in as fair a way as possible. This is the scenario that provides the moral validation for the mandatory retirement policies in place at so many companies. You have occupied the corner office for 16 years. Now it's someone else's turn. If you don't retire and get out of the way, she might leave our firm and go to work for our competitor. You have had a good run. Now be a good fellow and do the decent thing. Go away. Of course, if this were true, it would make no sense for any company to purchase any other company, because the net sum of all that would be acquired is the responsibility to feed several hundred new mouths. When war leads one country to conquer and occupy another, it is not because the stronger country felt an altruistic impulse to feed millions of new citizens. In both cases, it is because smart leaders realize that the human being is the only creature on the planet with the capacity to create value that vastly exceeds its own needs. Provided that the corporation has been structured in a way to allow each employee to function at a level close to maximum creativity and productivity, the more employees and the larger the company, the more productive and profitable it can be. People can create wealth, and they do it chiefly through a spiritual rather than a material process. Because a human's spiritual potential can continue increasing as he or she ages, a human's wealth-producing potential carries no expiration date. For this reason, declining populations worry statesmen. For instance, in 1986, when it first became apparent that France's birth rate had fallen to 1.8, which is well below minimum replacement level of 2.1, the French government announced a program to encourage larger families. They would award mothers who gave birth to a third or subsequent child a temporary maternal salary of about $300 a month for 3 years. West Germany has a birth rate of 1.3, and Britain and the Scandinavian countries are experiencing similar population crises. In demographic terms, Europe is vanishing, said then-French Prime Minister Jacques Chirac in 1986. If people were nothing more than mouths and needed feeding, lower populations would be seen as blessings rather than as the problems they now are. Even in the United States, the birth rate is well below replacement levels, which could result in only 1.5 workers available to support each Social Security beneficiary by the year 2030, instead of the 3.5 workers available today. The very fact that this is considered a problem reveals that people are creative and productive assets. Ben Wattenberg, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, began warning about this problem many years ago. There is a relationship between the size of a population and its power in the world. Belgium is not going to build a 747 airplane. Luxembourg is not going to have a Star Wars system. The only countries to launch aircraft carriers recently are the U.S. and the USSR, because it takes an enormous population base to pay the taxes, to provide the money for these inordinately expensive weapons and technologies. The Club of Modern Democratic Nations now accounts for about 1/7 of the global population. At the end of World War II, these nations had about 1/4 of the world's population. If present trends continue, Western countries will go down to 1/10 or 1/12 of the global population by 2050. On balance, it is a lot more difficult to have a dominant culture when you're 1/15 of the world than when you're 1/4. The history of civilization is one of nations and cultures growing and then dying. There is nothing to say that our particular democratic club will last forever. I talked to a manufacturer of baseball gloves. You don't have to look out very far, 5 to 10 years, and the market of young boys is going to shrink substantially. After listening to me, he said, "Holy smoke, I'm in trouble." And I said, "Right, you've got it." Sustaining the retirement myth contributes to people mistakenly subscribing to the notion that humans are chiefly consumers rather than creators, and that as such, the best way to run business affairs is to minimize the number of these consumers. What is worse is that with retirement an essential component of your lifespan, you are far more likely to subconsciously think of yourself as a consumer rather than as a creator. If deep in your heart you suspect yourself to be nothing more than a mouth needing to be fed, the likelihood of your coming up with creative ideas is drastically diminished. Retirement feeds the materialistic myth that the only way to create wealth is by physical labor. Unless I am mining, manufacturing, or growing something, I cannot be creating wealth. Under the terms of this myth, obviously someone whose physical strengths are in decline is someone who cannot possibly be making any contribution. Not only is she not adding to the common wealth of her society, she is no longer even capable of contributing to her own needs. Society must take care of her. In reality, if 84-year-old John spends the morning at a coffee shop helping to persuade middle-aged Tom to invest the money that will enable young Dick to buy elderly Harry's auto repair business, and if the deal is structured so that John earns a commission, John has just created considerable wealth. He has directly added to the wealth of himself and three others, and he has indirectly contributed to the wealth of the entire neighborhood. In fact, during this almost relaxed morning of conversations, John has probably created more wealth than he created all month in his earlier life as an employee of a furniture factory. Then he needed a strong back and sure eyes as he assembled high-quality office furniture. Now he may be physically less active, but by virtue of his highly developed spiritual skills, he is creating far more than he is consuming. With retirement in your mind as a step on life's road, you are far less likely to be a fountain of creativity. Your subconscious awareness of that expiration date suppresses your productivity and imposes artificial limits on your life. The real role of work. God placed man into the Garden of Eden to work it. Judaism teaches that this work was to be man's source of satisfaction. In this, he would fulfill his destiny as a partner of his Creator in the act of creation. Through work, he would prove that he was indeed created in God's image, because he was to be Earth's only creature capable of the same creativity as God himself. There was no time limit or age limit placed on Adam's mandate to work. The book of Job later repeated and emphasized the essential link between human satisfaction and work with the words, "Man was born to work." You work not because you need the results of that work, but because there is intrinsic meaning and value in the work itself. That meaning emerges from the fact that your work benefits others. That it should also benefit others is an accompanying side effect that should not surprise anyone who sees God as benevolent. I cannot overemphasize this essential point. Business success depends on working in order to benefit others. Your customers or clients, your employees, and your community. That should be your primary motivation. The obvious question is, how do I know that I am bringing benefit to others? Perhaps by spray-painting graffiti on neighborhood walls, I am really bringing benefit and beauty to unappreciative locals. That is where pay and profit come in. Without these indispensable barometers of people's desires, people would all be inflicted with the involuntary consequences of activists' enthusiasms. By bestowing the gift of money on his children, God gave them the advantage of being able to be supplied with the things that they want, rather than with the things that others think they should have. Pay and profit tell you that you are supplying a need and filling other people's wants. They are not the motivation for your work. They are the validation of your work. One of the famous Talmudic stories that has embedded itself in the collective subconscious of the Jewish business professional over the centuries concerns the righteous Honi. One day Honi was journeying on a road and saw an elderly man planting a carob tree. He asked him, "How long does it take for this tree to bear fruit?" The man told Honi that it would take about 70 years. Honi asked the man, "Do you suppose that you will live long enough to eat the fruit?" The man replied that he had found mature carob trees waiting for him in the world. "Just as my fathers planted them for me, I plant these for my children." The idea that emerges from this story reaffirms that work is chiefly about how other people will benefit from your efforts. It may be today, or it may be in the future. But engaging in work is a moral, benevolent, and caring thing to do. Jewish tradition also ascribes one additional benefit to work, and that is a sense of self-worth and independence. Discussing mutual obligations, the Talmud analyzes a situation in which Jacob deposited 10 bushels of wheat with Joseph for safekeeping while he was out of the country for several months. It turned out that the value of the wheat was shrinking, perhaps due to a dropping market in wheat or maybe a fungus of some kind. The morality question was whether Joseph is obliged to sell the wheat on Jacob's behalf in order to preserve its value, knowing that he would be able to repurchase the same amount of wheat later once Jacob returned to reclaim his wheat. The answer would appear to be obvious. Joseph must do what he can to preserve and protect the value of his friend's wheat. So why even discuss it? The Talmud reminds us that no wheat on earth will ever taste as good to Jacob as the wheat he himself grew. The analogy indicated by the Talmud is that people prefer to earn their own way instead of depending on the benevolence of others. Work is the mechanism that allows you the self-respect of knowing that when you eat as a result of having done good for others in the world. Anyone unfortunate enough to be living off the sweat and perspiration from someone else's brow is said by the Talmud to be eating the bread of shame. Although retirees may well see themselves to be living on their accumulated savings and investments rather than on the largesse of others, they are nonetheless contributing far less to the world than they might have, were they creatively at work. In a certain sense, to retire is to write the end before the story has rightfully ended. Why terminate the exciting journey prematurely? Arriving often turns out to be less than the trip itself had been. Ending your creative career is like shutting down the engines. You have arrived. Robert Louis Stevenson said, "To travel hopefully is a better thing than to arrive." Continuing your business activities is the very best way of always traveling hopefully throughout your life. In this way, you can prosper. And better yet, you can help others to be doing so too. Your path to prosperity. Stop thinking of retirement as a goal with a specific date in mind. And stop thinking of work as a temporary or finite function, something that you should just stop doing one day. Work is valuable beyond its money-generating benefits. It keeps you vital, involved in life, and part of a community of others, all of which are necessary for survival and longevity. Recognize that many people lead very productive lives long into their advanced years. Sam Walton didn't found Walmart until he was 44 years old, and Colonel Sanders didn't start selling Kentucky Fried Chicken until he was retired at the age of 65. Sanders didn't like retirement, and the next 15 years were the most successful and productive of his long life. Understand that retirement is essentially selfish. Working productively means that you are caring for others. It is hard to maintain meaningful relationships with others when you are retired because you are concerned chiefly with yourself. And it shows. If you are getting paid to do something, rest assured you're doing something that is meaningful and valuable to at least one other person. No retired person has a reliable indicator of his or her usefulness to others. Keep in mind that retirement erodes perseverance, which is one of the most important factors to success. Shrugging off failure and redoubling efforts takes perseverance. Picking oneself up off the ground to where one has been knocked down and taking another shot at the goal takes perseverance. resisting pain, sometimes humiliation too, and remaining stubbornly focused on the task, takes enormous reserves of perseverance. And perseverance leads to improvement in attaining one's goals. Don't believe the three lies inherent in the retirement myth. First, reject the idea that work is only a means to an end. Instead, recognize that work is valuable. You should live to work, and you should enjoy the work you do. Second, don't buy into the idea that as you age, you become weaker and less capable of making money. The opposite is actually true. You know more about your craft or area of expertise. You know more people who can help you or benefit from your work. And you are more mature in dealing with adversity. Third, ignore the misperception that people are merely voracious consumers of finite resources. Instead, recognize that you are a creator of something useful and valuable. You are productive. Epilogue. Life is business, and business is life. Learn one, and you will have also learned the other. My Uncle Joe spent his later days driving dusty country roads in a Rolls Royce. He was a manufacturer's representative. He was a very successful manufacturer's representative. Early in life, he had built up a business importing and servicing high-end European and Japanese audio equipment. Without even thinking about it, he practiced all the Ten Commandments of this book and became wealthy. His business prospered until he sold his growing company to a conglomerate for a great deal of money. Because he would never have violated either the Tenth Commandment by retiring or his non-compete agreement by opening up another business, he was in a quandary. Then he realized that nothing in his agreement prevented him from working for another company, or even several companies. He approached manufacturers, importers, and wholesalers, and offered to go on the road selling their products to the more remote retailers that other salespeople were reluctant to service. I was a rather unaccomplished and impecunious rabbinical school graduate at the time, when I noticed that my elderly uncle was well on his way to building his second fortune. Should I overcome both my pride and a slight intellectual disdain for business and appeal to him for the opportunity to work for him, I wondered. Testing the waters one day, I began by asking him what it was exactly that he did. His soft-spoken answer astounded me, because I realized that he really believed what he told me. What he said was, "Daniel, I help hundreds of store owners around the country make a very good living." In an instant, it dawned on me that he wasn't working in order to drive a Rolls-Royce motor car. He was driving a fine car in order to better help other people get what they wanted. My eyes must have betrayed my inner turmoil, because he continued explaining as if to a child, which I suppose in a sense I was, "I supply the desirable goods that the customers of my customers really want." He then generously offered me the chance to join him for a while. He provided me with catalogs and descriptions of the various products we represented, and gave me a list of lonely stores to visit. Upon returning from my 700-mile excursion with nary an order to show for my mileage, I began a lengthy and complicated explanation of why I had not sold any merchandise. He gently interrupted me. "Daniel, you don't have to give me the story, because I am quite good at putting together the story myself. You just give me the numbers, and I'll tell you the story. How many stores did you visit? How long did you spend at each store? How many other people were in the store? Were they customers or other salespeople? How many products did you demonstrate? How many orders did you write? Again, I had an insight. My uncle, the business professional, was teaching me, the rabbi, a Torah lesson. In Hebrew, the same word sofer is used to describe a scribe, a scholar, and a counter, which is to say someone good with numbers. You can never become an accomplished scholar without allowing numbers to root you in reality. Stories allow your imagination to soar unencumbered by anything as inconvenient as the laws of physics. Numbers are real and can reflect reality far more quickly and far more accurately than stories. I suspect that there may be an inverse relationship between the value of a financial report and the ratio of stories to numbers found in that report. Numbers should not need too many words to explain them. You give me the numbers, and I'll figure out the story, just as my Uncle Joe said. Numbers reflect reality, and business depends on numbers because it is reality. Uncle Joe quickly uncovered one reason for my poor performance on that first trip. I had shown some irritation at how long I was kept waiting by store proprietors while they attended to their customers. After all, I had thought, I have come all this way to show him the latest in stereo sound equipment, and he leaves me sitting around for over an hour. You are not there for your purposes. You are there for his, reprimanded my uncle. Business is about helping other people. I believe that the entire Torah and all the history of the Jewish experience supports the view that to achieve long-term success in business, you have to learn how to behave in the moral, ethical, and courteous way that the good Lord intended. If you are in business, then in almost everything you do, satisfying at least one other person is a prerequisite for success. You must remember that unless you are a Supreme Court judge or a tenured university professor, you are in business. I jokingly consider these two occupations to be typical of the very few modern jobs in which satisfying your customers or clients is entirely unnecessary. Being a judge, a professor, or even a university student is to be strangely isolated from reality. It is perhaps no accident that business professionals without advanced academic degrees frequently outperform those that do. Nearly one-third of the companies on the 2002 Forbes 500 list are headed by CEOs without master's degrees. Those companies did better for their shareholders than the others on the list. In schools, for their own good reasons, professors frequently reward effort and intent. The student thus obtains an impressive grade for a mediocre product. However, in both the real world and in business, performance counts far more than intent and excuses. Whether you intended to mow the lawn, repair the car, or deliver the pizza is less important than whether you actually did those things. At least that is how it works in the real world. Business could be a better preparation for reality than school is. In many environments, including some schools, people are encouraged to focus on their feelings and to act on them. They adoringly refer to this as honesty. In the real world, however, you often need to behave courteously, and yes, occasionally even deferentially, to individuals you may loathe. This is the basis of both international diplomacy and the marketplace. The world responds favorably to you by how you actually behave, rather than by what you feel. Business should remind you that most other people are not particularly interested in how you feel. They care how you act. In the real world, you simply cannot have everything you want. You have limited energies and resources to exchange for the goods and services you want. Therefore, you must accustom yourself to deciding which things you really want and which you are prepared to forfeit. Business is one of the few cultural institutions that does impart a real-world understanding that nobody has a right to any material thing or to anyone else's labor. These can only be acquired in exchange for what you have to offer. And what you have to offer is not infinite. The culture in the United States seems to emphasize individualism in how it idolizes stars in both entertainment and sports. Yet the real world truth is that cooperation with others is the key to success. This is the secret of the corporation. One apple plus another apple equals two apples. But one person plus another person equals not two, but three, four, or perhaps 20. The best ways to teach cooperation are through team sports and through business. Today it may not really be practicable, but in theory I would rather apprentice my son to a top-rate business professional like my old Uncle Joe than have him spend 4 years in the best university in the country. I suspect that in this fashion he would emerge better equipped for real life. In this book, I have provided a picture of what one would learn if apprenticed to the economic and philosophic vision of business as found in ancient Jewish wisdom. It has been painful for me to realize that for half my life, I inadvertently erected a barrier between my theoretical knowledge and my practical activities. Writing this book has been anguishing in that sense. I naturally wish that I had always followed these 10 commandments. If I had, my success would have been more numerous, and my failures fewer and less painful. Learning from the tried and tested principles of one of history's most successful peoples is surely more prudent than working it out as one goes along. You can learn these principles, apply them, and prosper. Not only can you now start to follow the 10 commandments of making money, but in so doing, not only shall you prosper economically, but you shall also be improving your life, and even more important, the lives of everyone around you.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Thou Shall Prosper, 10 Commandments for Making Money. Written by Rabbi Daniel Lappin. Narrated by A.C. Fellner. Executive Producer, Jennifer Basick. Producer, Mike Charzik. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2002 by Rabbi Daniel Lappin. Production copyright 2010 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.